Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
Welcome to the Mormon Matters Podcast. I'm your guest host, Katie Langston, and I'm delighted to be here today because we have a wonderful panel prepared for you. The last time I guest hosted was a wonderful conversation with Dan Witherspoon and Mary Beth Raines on Fowler's Stages of Faith. And you can go back, that's Mormon Matters episodes number 228 and 229. We talked about sort of the evolution of a person through a faith journey, according to this developmental model that James Fowler and other theorists had posited. Well, today, we're going to sort of build on that conversation, but instead of talking about individuals' developmental stages, we're going to talk about how societies, cultures, and institutions also evolve and develop and go through stages. So we're going to be talking about how getting a feel for that can help us in our own spiritual journeys, but can also be an important part of how we interact within our culture, within our society, and, you know, specifically within our church, and how that can sort of help us see a new way of interacting with the church and the people in it. So super excited. We've got a really wonderful panel today, and we're going to start with letting each of them introduce themselves. And we'll start with the fearless leader and host of Mormon Matters, Dan Witherspoon. Dan, why don't you share just a little bit about yourself?
Thanks, Katie, and thanks for doing this again. And you were a great host last time when Mary Beth and I were on, and I'm excited that we've added a third person this time. But for those of you who know me, I've hosted the podcast now for coming up on four years, 200 and something episodes, and it's just a privilege to do it. My own background is, you know, in religious studies, a PhD in religion, a master's in religious studies, philosophy, and classic civilizations is kind of my other academic background, but active member of the church, living in Bountiful, Utah, couple of grown kids, so we're empty nesters, and this is the kind of thing I love to do with my life, so thanks for everybody for helping make it happen.
Thank you, Dan. We also want to introduce again to you Mary Beth Raines, who was on for the previous Stages of Faith episode. Mary Beth, why don't you share a little bit about yourself?
I have a couple of academic strains that I came through, and it's informed me greatly. I have a master's degree from Brigham Young University in marriage and family sociology, essentially, and that discusses a lot of stages in development. And then I have also a master's degree in social work from the University of Utah, in which the practical and clinical applications of theories are well used, and so I have enjoyed being a therapist for the last 35 years. I also have 3 adult children and 10 grandchildren. So I am well on my way to expanding family, and I enjoy a lot of social causes and interests over time in terms of speaking and some writing and being on committees. So, thank you.
Thank you. We're just thrilled to have you. Thank you, Mary Beth. And finally, we have returning to the podcast, Brad Kramer. Brad, why don't you share a little bit about yourself?
Thanks for the invite on this panel. My academic background is I have a master's degree in U.S. history from the University of Utah and a Ph.D. in anthropology from the University of Michigan. For the Ph.D., I actually did work on Mormonism, really on Mormonisms. I did a comparative look at the mainline LDS church as well as the Cutlerite church in Independence, Missouri, looking at things like verbal taboo, unmentionability, secrecy, confidentiality, and how those things factor into sort of how we make and experience the sacred and the non-sacred. I currently teach U.S. history and anthropology at Utah Valley University. I also do publicity and marketing for Greg Coford Books. And I have 5 not grown children, very much not grown children. My spouse and I live in Draper, Utah. And I'm really appreciative of the invitation here.
All right. Thanks, Brad. We're delighted to have you. To get our conversation started today, we want to turn some time over to Dan, first of all, to kind of give us an initial framing for the podcast and sort of, you know, what he has in mind and why this topic is so important. So, Dan.
Thanks. Yeah. Well, you know, if anything else, this is a kind of a cross between two of our previous episodes. Katie mentioned Stages of Faith, one that we did kind of with help from James Fowler, making it through faith transitions. And then there was another one, Katie, that you were on along with Bonner Ritchie and Bill Hansen and I. And that was about how institutions and individuals interact with each other, and sometimes institutions can be a bit challenging for individual freedom and things like that. And that was episode 190 and 191. So this, to me, is kind of a cross between the two of them. We're taking the idea of Fowler and personal development. We're going to be throwing it into how institutions and, like you mentioned, cultures and societies change. And because of the changes in those societies and cultures, different kinds of institutions emerge with different centers of value, and they kind of call forth to have different, you know, types of people that thrive well within certain institutional environments. And yet, the beautiful thing about this is, guess what? They do change. And so, you know, a lot of times we'll kind of run into a sort of a defeatist attitude, or, you know, the church that, you know, you guys are aspiring to and talking about is as Mormonism, that's really not Mormonism. That's, you know, institutional Mormonism will never let us go that way. And I just want to kind of counterbalance that and say, guess what? They do change. So if nothing else, I just want us to kind of have a little bit of theoretical background. I don't know how deep into any minutia we want to go, but just this idea of institutional growth and development, how individuals, you know, certain personality types, certain temperaments, certain ways of orienting your life kind of come and go with those different changes in institutions. And hopefully then we can kind of see how that applies for today. So that was my goal. So hope that works with everybody.
Wonderful. That sounds great. Yeah. So we want to start out, Brad, kind of, why don't you talk a little bit about your sense of the LDS Church's development over time and how that relates to kind of what Dan just said, you know, from a historical perspective and from a developmental, institutional development perspective.
Okay, so a couple of things I want to say at the outset. One is that, you know, in social science, in sociology and anthropology and communications theory, you know, actor network theory, et cetera, there are so many different approaches that people take to the question of what is an institution, what is a religion, what is a church, what is a corporation, how do these things shift, how do they relate to individuals that comprise them or that are members of them or that are in some way affiliated with them. And I think that on the practical level, if we're looking for something to sort of ground our understanding as church members, or we're basically looking for something that is more helpful or less helpful and kind of navigating our own relationship with an institution that's important all in our lives. So I want to be careful at the outset and in the first place by noting that we're not, at least I'm not intending to sort of proffer a grand unified theory of what the church is
right.
or, you know, a kind of definitive account of what our relationship to it should be. And also to note that my the sort of model that I am going to articulate here isn't actually strongly grounded in any particular social theory or institutional theory. It's more intuitive on my part. But for that reason, I found it helpful, and I know some others have found it helpful, and in part because it actually does what you described, Dan. It kind of bridges the gap between thinking about sort of individual development, individual shifts, sort of on the micro level, and then on the macro level, institutional development, institutional change, institutional qualities, and how those two relate to each other. So My initial impetus for sort of developing this way of thinking about my own relationship with the church and other people's relationship with the church is kind of twofold. One was a conversation with Adam Miller a while back, and he ended up developing this in some of his writing, but we had a conversation once where he described the notion of faithfulness in what, for me at least, was a very novel way. Because I think in Mormonism we tend to think about faithfulness as just sort of in terms of a very kind of McConkie-esque approach to being faithful to the church, which means believing or the right things, understanding correct principles, accepting that certain things are true. And it's a very mental, very almost epistemological approach to faithfulness. And Adam was proposing to think about faithfulness in relational terms, like faithfulness to a spouse. In other words, you have an obligation to remain faithful despite the other person's shortcomings or problems, and that faithfulness is something like you would never just keep a checklist on a spouse and say like, oh well, if I don't believe X, Y, and Z about your background, then I'm just going to stop being faithful to you.
Right. Good.
So that was helpful for me, but I also began to realize just from my own introspection that my own relationship to Mormonism, and when I say to Mormon, I mean really to the Mormon Church, to the LDS Church, my relationship to church leadership, to church authority, has tracked pretty closely over the course of my life to my relationship to my parents in terms of their moral authority and the role that they play in my life. And I would say actually that's particularly true in the case of my father, which I think is probably as much as anything else a reflection of the fact that it's a very patriarchal church. So then I just started kind of thinking, trying to extrapolate this out. Does it make sense to think about the relationship between individuals and the church, again, or faithfulness in relational terms, but maybe perhaps more in something like parent-child terms rather than spousal terms? Because I think that that's a relational framing that more traditional church members would probably be comfortable with, because it entails a certain submission, right? There's the submitting like a child, submitting your will to the will of the Father kind of thing. So the submission to authority dimension is captured in that relationship. So I go from there, and as I'm starting to think about this, I'm thinking, well, yeah, it turns out I think that the church is actually itself kind of frames its relationship to us in parent-child terms and asks us to be submissive like a child. And the church itself, so this question of there being this sort of parent-child dynamic between individuals and the church is not the same thing as, but is related to, I think, another issue, which is that the church itself is developing. I mean, we often talk about the church, early period of the church, as the church being in its infancy. We talk about maturity as an institution. And I think that, and we are a young church. We are a comparatively young religion, especially, you know, by comparison to other religions that we'd like to compare ourselves to, you know. And I think that there's some fear that part of the way that I think we can understand this sort of period of glasnost that we're going through is that the information age is forcing us to shift the kind of relationship that we have with the church. And that's a shift away from a kind of childlike naivete about, I mean, think about the way that young children think about their parents, right? Like assuming that you have a healthy relationship with your parents as a young child, you think that in some sense you think your parents are all powerful or all wise. You're absolutely submissive to them, because you need to be protected by them, you need to be taught by them. There's a kind of a relationship of authority that also includes moral authority, intellectual authority, and not a relationship that it's your place to really question as a child. And on the other hand, adults can also have very healthy relationships with their parents, including relationships that involve a certain degree of authority and even moral authority. But it's very different from a child. So if you're, as an adult, you're going to have a healthy relationship with your parent that includes a certain acknowledgement of your parent's moral authority in your life, it's going to be sort of with your eyes open, right? You're no longer going to entertain any of the childlike absolutes about who your parents are, about their perfection, about their power, about their, you know, all-wise understanding. You're going to see them clearly, but at the same time, the fact that you see them clearly and you see their fallibility, that you see their problems, their limitations, and maybe even you recognize, you know, the mistakes that they made, things that they did wrong to you. It doesn't necessarily mean that you're just going to dissociate yourself from them. You're going to end the relationship. The relationship is going to change. And I think especially for kind of progressive Mormons, that view of a more kind of adult parent-child relationship with the church is one that is very appealing. It's very, you know, it's one that strongly resonates with us. I think on the other hand, there's a certain kind of comfort in the very childlike relationship that also has its own kind of appeal. But I think there's another dimension to this, which I think in part explains the anxiety on the church, on the part of the church, which is itself a young institution. It kind of seems like the church doesn't, as an institution, doesn't idealize our relationship with it in terms of adult child to parent, but rather tries to kind of lock us into a very childlike relationship with it.
Meaning in some ways that the church hasn't yet reached adult status to where an adult
right.
knows how to interact with an adult at a different level than that adult knows how to interact with a child. You're basically saying we're probably more still like an adolescent church.
Well, that's the thing we have to bring into the conversation is adolescence, right? And adolescence is interesting because, I mean, again, we're talking sort of in terms of stereotypes because we're trying to develop a model, right? But if there's anything that stereotypically describes an adolescent, and especially an adolescent's changing relationship with his or her parents, it's that when you become a teenager, suddenly you become sort of you come to question everything about your parents. Like suddenly you no longer believe that they're smarter than you. You no longer believe that they understand the world better than you. But there can be a kind of petulance to it, right? Like just a kind of dismissiveness altogether, because suddenly you've realized So it sort of combines on the one hand a realization of all your parents' weaknesses and maybe even an exaggeration of those weaknesses in your own mind with a kind of casual dismissiveness and an overconfidence in your own ability to navigate the world free of your parents' influence.
And so are you seeing the church in that right now? Or,
well,
you know, because to me what adolescence means, partly, I mean, all the things that you said, but it's like I'm negotiating a whole new relationship, you know, when I'm on the cusp of coming
yeah.
into my own, of confidence and stuff like that. Because, you know, in adolescence, man, it's like, what do other people think about me? Will they like me? Do they accept me? If I don't live up to expectations, there's something wrong with me, and you're not yet able to kind of see that it's the system or it's the unwritten things out there that are shaping the forces, peer pressure and all that kinds of stuff on you. And so that's what adolescence means to me. And I really think that the model of the church at one point being a very child, you know, it was in its infancy, like you talked about in here, completely dependent upon, you know, what we thought was God for its very survival. I mean, it was threatened. It was kicked out of here. You know, you had to see terms, the church, you know, everything else in terms of us versus them. You know, the whole point was, you know, God has called us, but we're in this vulnerable position. So just like childs with parents, but now we have moved into this thing and we want it to become more of an adult, right?
Yeah,
can I
exactly.
I'd like to jump in with a little bit of a way to unify so we don't just see as the child
Thanks.
And the adolescent stages as split. And that is, somebody pointed out to me years ago that when we go through adolescence, we don't actually give up the connection to our parents. We're actually taking what is their most deepest values and trying to understand them, reconstruct them, incorporate peer and other cultural views into those very values. But we still honor those values. They may look very different as we move into the adult stage in practice, but they still honor it in some way. So let's take service as a very strong ethic within the church, and then some families have a very strong ethic. Whether somebody remains very active and believingly faithful, or whether they in fact at some point leave, service, if it's really embedded, will then still be a core value. So I think there's a unitive set of deep structure processes that go on. It just looks very different on the exterior as we go from stage to stage.
Yeah, I agree. And I think one of the things I wanted to kind of flesh out on the other side of this sort of adolescent stage of the model is that there is, as you guys know, there's a very healthy model of adolescence too, which is this sort of model of negotiation. The relationship is shifting, but it's not defined solely in terms of mistrust or petulance towards parents. But there's another dimension here too, which is that on the one hand, the church is going through its own developmental, sort of its own process of maturity. But at the same time, it preserves a kind of parental relationship with us as members. And so the model that I'm suggesting is that the kind of parent-child relationship that it expects, that the church tends to expect from us, is a reflection of where it's at in its own stage of maturity.
Right.
So when the church is in a childlike, sort of itself as an institution is in this kind of childlike position, it demands childlike fealty from us, childlike faithfulness and submission from us. And optimally, I mean, you could sort of, again, speaking in very general stereotypes, you could look at other older religious traditions, something like Judaism, for example, and say, in Judaism, there's still a very strong sense of faithfulness and a very serious relationship that believing Jews have with tradition, with scripture, with God. But then in some sense, those things are also more mature, they're more adult than they are in a lot of traditional Mormonism, in part because that faith itself has had time to mature, and so the demands that it makes from its membership or from its adherents mature themselves over time. And so you can look at where we're at and what's happening now as this kind of beginning of this transition where the church is beginning to open up and beginning to sort of invite us to have a slightly more adult relationship with it and to view it and to understand it in slightly more adult terms and slightly more nuanced terms and just less childlike terms. However, I do think there's also an anxiety there, and that's around the understanding, at least the intuitive understanding, that the transition from a childlike relationship to an adult relationship has to go through adolescence, and adolescence is can be scary because sometimes teenagers leave, and or sometimes kids become teenagers and their parents feel like they lose them.
Thank you very much.
It turns out in adolescence that parents do not lose their children if there's a core of really love, care, concern, if that's one of the dominant values, even though they may be very high structure, very even rigid about this just happened this way. If there's that core warmth and love, that can go through all stages in and out, but they don't lose them. And so many times in the church, I think that balance between justice and mercy in different families and within different wards or bishops or church culture can get tipped either towards more justice or more mercy. And so the more it's towards justice in a critical, a hurtful way, the more people you're going to lose. But if it's tipped in the other way, I think you're going to keep people in some way.
Thanks, Mary Beth, for those comments. And I wanted to kind of explore a little bit more deeply sort of your knowledge base, talking specifically about institutional developmental theory. I know that you have some background, especially perhaps as articulated by Ken Wilber and others. And why don't you kind of tie that into what Brad has been saying and maybe share with us a little bit more of a theoretical framework that can sort of help us understand what's going on?
Well, there's been a long tradition of developmental theory as moving through stages, and it will move roughly in some ways that Brad has been talking about. You, Brad, have pointed out in a way that makes it immediately applicable for people. Most of these theories don't make it immediately applicable for people.
Yeah.
So in order to not take too much time, I would just ask listeners to Google culture developmental stage theory, and a whole Wikipedia site will come up that is several, many, many pages long. And if you're interested in the history of the theory about the stages of culture and the stages of institutions within culture and so on, it's there. And there are other sites too. So rather than taking the time, let me just briefly say that many theorists, let's say take Ken Wilber, James Fowler, and others, have followed, Robert Kagan from Harvard University has a book called Inner Aura Heads that have looked at individual development and across cognitive, emotional, social, moral reasoning, spiritual stages, and they all make a big rubric that we roughly follow through stages, and it's coordinated or controlled by the stages of cognitive development, even though that's not the only factor. So this stage-wide theory, as people evolutionarily, so to speak, go from one stage to the next, and there's a lot in family stage theory, we go from one stage to the next in a sequential way. And there's been a lot of theory historically that we go from one stage to the next. And so it makes it quite useful. Parenting manuals, for instance, use it quite a lot. Developmental education, we use it for schools, for psychology classes. It's used in clinically in some ways. However, there's been a lot of discussion in the last 20 years that maybe, you know, a stair-step sort of evolutionary pattern. It may not be the case, that actually we evolve very differently. And in the postmodern era, it's we go in cycles and we're grounded, as Ken Wilber says, by our own children, in that when a society moves from one stage to the next, you always have children who have to go through those individual stages, even though a culture or subculture may be at a more developed stage in terms of compassion and love while still having structure and loyalty as being important factors. So right now I can't say, well, this is the way institutions go, and then, you know, this is how families go, this is how the church go, because it's a big debate right at the moment. However, I think it is useful still as a tool to use maybe even two or three stages to essentially use Brad's model to say, how do we use a lens that then we can orient ourselves to? And I think his model is quite useful. So I'm going to end this little piece by quoting again Lavina Anderson, as I did the last podcast, which is that in the church we are taught that we are a child of God, but that as we start to question and intellectually, you know, make sense of things or add more experience in, we become adolescents of God. But what God really wants is adults of God, alluding to this adults parent-child relationship that you're talking about, Brad.
Yeah, he doesn't want us to be like children. He wants us to leave Eden, right? And to return to him, right? Eden is a state of childlike innocence, and where you have a kind of oneness, a kind of direct connection with God. But he wants us to return, but we can't return to Eden as children. We have to return to Eden knowing good and evil, having experienced difficult life in the real world, having come to recognize and understand certain things, having a certain wisdom, and having found our way back to God as adults.
Let me jump in here. This is a post-production edit from me, Dan, because it was something that I'd intended to bring up in the podcast, but we never really got to the perfect stopping spot. So I'd been kind of looking for it as I've been editing this and getting ready for there. So I just want to at least throw in right now something that I think relates right to where we are in this discussion. It's things that have come up. I think I've brought it up a couple of times in the podcast before. I've had Phil McLemore on the podcast, and I think I forced him to give his model once. But I do really think that there's a beautiful scriptural set of metaphors and things like that that talk about different relationships between God and us that I think would fit right in here as we're talking now about, you know, being adults of God, you know, how the church wants to somehow, it seems like, keep us more as children, but ultimately, really, we know that it truly would understand in its teachings that we can't stay children forever. So anyway, let me quickly offer a reminder of five beautiful stages that Phil McLemore is, at least as far as I know, he developed these out of scriptural metaphors. The first one is the parent-child relationship, and we've kind of discovered that where, you know, the child looks to the parent for protection, for wisdom, for basically all things, and it's a highly dependent position. The second one that he talks about is a relationship that we might want to think of as the steward and master relationship. In other words, there's the Lord of the vineyard, he has the steward, he wants workers. And, you know, you're well accepted and you're viewed well by the master of the vineyard for your service to him and the growth of his, you know, vineyard or whatever you'd want to call it. In this case, your service to the kingdom of God or something like that would be there. And so the church certainly encourages us to think in terms of not only parent and child, I'm a child of God, etc., but to be good stewards, wise stewards. The third stage that he talks about is disciple and master. And again, we get the word discipleship that comes in Mormonism, but discipleship is often, you know, not really quite analyzed, because in the wider, I don't know, maybe Eastern traditions, as we think of gurus and their students as disciples, the thing about a disciple is the disciple understands that I am going through this apprenticeship, or I am doing these disciplines, the same root, disciple and discipline, in order to one day become like the master, to become like my sensei, or etc. In other words, I fully expect, as I work here, that you and I, one day, master, would be colleagues. We would be, you know, on the same level. And so the church, you know, has the word disciple in it. And we, Neil Maxwell, boy, discipleship was his word of the century when it came to his talks all the time. But I don't know that sometimes we're completely comfortable with this idea that, if we interact with or if we encourage too much discipleship, guess what? That involves them growing. And again, as Brad kind of had said in our little discussion here, growing is often painful. Growing can lead to difficult things. And so there's a love-hate relationship with the idea of the church encouraging us to be disciples. But he says that there's two other models that are at least scriptural that we ought to be thinking of. And the next one is that Jesus is calling us to be friend, to have an ease, to have confidence. Our confidence would wax strong in the presence of God. We would have a mutual enjoyment, this sort of sense that once the disciple becomes like the master, they become friends. I know this happened with my professors and things like in my PhD program. Certainly at some point we shifted to where, you know, I've got a doctorate too, they've got a doctorate, and now we're more colleagues, a lot different types of interactions there. And I really think that that's the scriptures calling us to that as well. And then finally, the most beautiful stage is God calling us to be beloved, to be the bride, to his bridegroom, to enter into a union of full communion, full intimacy, full sharing, and all those different things. And that's another relationship that's sitting out there. And then I think the deeper gospel calls us to, the scriptures call us to, our church hasn't quite caught up to always be speaking in that language. It's there, but it certainly implies a lot of things that I think most people either don't grasp themselves, and therefore they don't share about it. Or again, it's just like, well, like Mary Beth says, you got to educate the children up to a certain point and things like this. And so it's just not as common and easy to speak about as some of the earlier stages are of especially parent-child and master-steward. I'll go back to the conversation now.
Let me give a little caveat in here. In terms of the personality theorists from Maslow on, and including Wilbur and probably 8 or 10 others, they also theorize stages of understanding and adulthood that go beyond adulthood, like the self-actualization stage of Maslow and so on, if people want to look it up. Most cultures don't grow to that stage. Individuals within a culture can grow to that stage, but given that every culture's big job is to keep itself alive and therefore educate its children and provide the basics for all of its members, you're only going to have individuals who go beyond that institutional structure, cultural structure, and whether it's a high rupture and trauma and grief or whether there's some way to go through that more readily, it depends upon the individual, or it's maybe some small groups or subgroups, but no culture at the moment will probably hit those higher let's call it expanded consciousness stages.
Thank you. Dan, what would you like to add here? Is there anything that you think you could pull from Fowler that would be applicable here, or what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I could go to Fowler right now, but I wanted to kind of stick go back a little bit more to first. The reason that cultures and societies develop the way they do also have to do with so many factors, like vulnerability to the weather, technological development, things like this. And so, like, Wilbur kind of looks at societies kind of going from, hunter-gatherer societies. And if you look at a hunter-gatherer society, 97% of the cultures, most of the hunting was done by the men and most of the gathering was done by the women, right? And it's biologically based and things like that. And so you had societies and structures that grew up around the necessities, like Mary Beth was saying, you've got to survive as a group. You've got to be able to pass things along to your children and stuff like that. Then we move into the agrarian age, and then we move forward and we move forward. And at each and every time, there's all these other factors that are completely, outside any one human or any kind of group deciding this is what we're going to do. It just sort of, there's this natural stuff that happens. And so each institution at each level, it may have grown up and it shaped itself to thrive within, what was necessary for this survival and things like this. And so when we do these transitions that she's talking about here, when we're moving to wider expanded consciousnesses or things like this, those old forms have to break down. Nobody was to blame for them, but they've got to break down and they've got to meet the new needs. And so Brad early on brought up, we're now in the information age. We're now, the internet and all that kind of stuff. We as a church are in one of these things that we didn't create this issue. It was, not perfectly. There was always been people who've sort of said, I'm feeling the rub with the institution all along here, but now we're in crisis here. We've got to adapt or die, and we are adapting, and I think we're seeing these, the gospel topics are starting to happen. We're seeing curriculum changes at CES. We're seeing, some movement on women's issues. We're seeing some movement on same-sex marriage and all the different, crisis points and the things that are applying the pressure. But I just kind of wanted to say that there's so many factors that no human being, I just want to say you can't blame them for not. We can't blame ourselves for not always seeing what's ahead, and then our institutions are always going to follow behind, sort of the change, and some institutions will die.
Some parts of them, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'll just let you know, I wrote a book for hire. I don't know, I wasn't an expertise, but I ghost wrote a book on clocks and the development of clocks in the Black Forest region of Germany. You know, this guy was an expert on this, but it was so interesting to see these clock makers and which companies survived and which ones didn't into the 21st century, because their companies were either able, you know, they, like some of them saw the handwriting on the wall that these big ornate desktop clocks were not going to survive. And so some of them went into, you know, wristwatches, and they began to kind of adjust with society, and others didn't. One of them, my favorite one, which was this highly technical, you know, the most sophisticated inner workings of the clocks in the 18th and 19th century, they're now an important environmental engineering firm today in Germany. You know,
wow.
So some survive and some don't. And you just, you know, I just want to take the blame out of it and just say the world marches on, things marching on. And you know, this idea that the Mormon Church or any group should be out in the lead, you know, I just want to calm that one down a little bit. You know, we've got a lot to do. So, sorry.
Well, one of the reasons I think cultures and institutions can move ahead developmentally or become, let's put it, like more inclusive in their compassionate and practical view of more and more of its members. That's the way, in some ways, I see development, that your circle of compassion increases, your circle of inclusive people to participate at every level of the culture gets more and more inclusive. However, we always have things that happen, this chaos, this point where it kind of devolves back to basics. So, for instance, Utah has the demographic of a third world country. We have a larger percentage of people under 18 in the United States than any other state. Because of that, we have more people at those beginning developmental child and adolescent stages. We're trying to educate, we're trying to keep them fed, we're trying to do all of that, and so high structure is important to do that. Now, the structure that works best is high warmth and high structure, and I see the church moving towards more and more warmth in most places, but all it takes is one person or one event or one whatever to kind of make it real judgmental, make it real critical, and then it kind of feels like it pulls us back down and we're making no progress. I don't see it that way. I think we are sequentially moving forward. It's just that we have all these factors that Dan's talking about, and I'm just adding another one in.
Yep.
I think you're describing a tension that we're all familiar with in the church, and then in some senses is always going to exist in any institution that has a kind of a relationship of dependency on its host society. Sociologists sometimes talk about this as optimized tension, in which the tension plays a crucial role, but it can't. But if it increases too much, it can be damaging. And so, you want to maintain a certain tension with the wider culture, but at the same time, but balance that with maintaining a certain harmony with the culture. In terms of individual experience, I think that, you know, we understand this tension, and we recognize this tension, and kind of as you described earlier, like there's a mercy and justice quality to it, or there's a kind of a warmth versus an authoritarian strictness.
It's not either or. You need both factors, and they can vary.
Yeah, this is what I'm saying. They're gonna both be present always, and the goal is to kind of optimize the tension between the two of them.
Oh, okay.
And that tension is a tension between individuals and the institution, but it's also a tension between the institution and the wider culture, and it's sort of always going to be present. And I think it's part of how this was helpful for me. Or I guess part of the way the sort of parental model was helpful for me in thinking about these tensions is because, you know, parents don't always do the right thing. We recognize this. We recognize it, I think, first as teenagers. But more significantly, I think we all recognize it in ourselves. We screw up as parents. We don't always do right by our kids. We all screw our kids up to some extent, and being a good parent doesn't mean you don't screw your kids up. It means that you, while you're screwing them up, you're also doing wonderful things for them, and on balance, you're having a much more positive effect than the negative. But there are these little kinds of abuses that don't necessarily define our relationship with our kids, but can often be present even in healthy relationships with kids. And frankly, sometimes parents are abusive, and sometimes children do experience not just intentional but unintentional abuse at the hands of parents. And so I think that this can help us not only to reckon with the problems that we see or that we experience with the church as an institution, moments where we felt mistreated, where we felt abused, or where we've seen it happen to other people, but also where we can be more compassionate with one another when it comes to our different experiences and the different kinds of relationships with the church that result from those different experiences. If you come go ahead.
So, Brett, hopefully I haven't stopped you mid-thought, but one of the things I'm noticing in our discussion is that we've done a great job of talking about the child and adolescent stage, but we haven't been talking about the adult stage. So what would an adult relationship with the church look like, or what an adult relationship with our parents look like? So I want to interject that question in, and if I interrupted you, I'm sorry, but I would like
It's actually perfect sort of interruption, because it's exactly where I was heading, one of the things that we do to develop an adult relationship with our parents is that we have to reconcile ourselves to sort of all the good and all the bad that our parents have done for us, all the strengths and weaknesses that they have. And, you know, most parents aren't don't have patterns of systematic abuse toward their children, but most parents do kind of harm their children some, and also do a lot of good for their children. And in some families, you can even imagine, you can imagine a family where you have two siblings, you have two sisters, and they both had difficult relationships with their parents growing up, as most of us do. You know, parenting is a very imperfect thing. And they both end up in kind of different places when it comes to relationships with parents. One has a much closer relationship despite a lot of the dysfunction, and one has decided to have a much more distant relationship with parents. And I think that those two siblings, because they recognize the combination of good and bad in their experience, can have a lot of compassion toward each other, maybe have a unique degree of compassion for each other, and even envy each other a little bit, right? If you're the sibling that has just said, look, I just can't handle the difficulty, I just had to walk away, I had to distance myself, but sometimes I really envy your ability to still have a close relationship with mom and dad despite the problems. Conversely, the sibling with a closer relationship could look at the other one and say, you know, sometimes I envy your ability to just sort of walk away and not maintain a close relationship. But at the same time, you know, I still value the relationship enough. And that's in a kind of outlying situation by itself. Most parent-child relationships, including through adolescence, yeah, there are problems, but on balance, they're pretty good. But coming into an adult relationship with your parents, especially when there are siblings involved, I think basically means a couple of things. One is reconciling yourself to all the good and the bad, to the clay feet that your parents have, to their imperfections, but also the great things that they really did do for you that maybe at some points in your adolescence you couldn't see. You know, you didn't have the maturity to see. But also reconciling yourself to the fact that you have siblings whose experience with your parents was different than yours, and are going to have a different relationship with your parents than you do. And you're going to learn to honor their experience, to respect their experience, and to have a good relationship with those siblings, despite the fact that maybe you and they have different relationships with your parents.
I agree. I'm going to jump in for a minute to do a real practical thing, if you don't mind, as a way to help push this idea that you can have an adult relationship not just within your family, but you can, I think, within the church. And
yes.
In the institutions that you develop, that you have at work, for instance, that's an institution, too, that will be somewhere along in stages and how they manage authority and mm-hmm. so on. one of the ways to look at how developed a person is how many modes of conflict resolution or negotiation they have available to them to use. And at the youngest stages, it's kind of fight or flight. But listeners may want to go online to a conflict mode instrument called the Thomas Kilman, K-I-L-M-A-N-N, Thomas Kilman Conflict Mode Instrument, or TKI. You can just Google TKI. This instrument, very short, 30-question questionnaire, differentiates among how much you use each of five negotiating styles, which are avoiding, accommodating, competing, compromising, and collaborating. So I've organized these from the simplest to the most complex, as you can hear. And so the idea about having an adult status by taking this instrument, and there's many training materials that are available, is that rather than, okay, I used to avoid or I used to compete and fight, a fight or flight, I'm now collaborating and that's the adult model. No, the adult model is that you have all available. You can use each one and you know when you're using it, why you're using it, and know when not to use it. So that follows on Ken Wilber's idea that the more sophisticated and adult development you have, you integrate and include all previous stages and capacities, not just say one and ignore or shelve all the previous ones.
That's very useful.
Fowler is fantastic on some of the stuff that you guys were just right on. So if you don't mind, Katie, I'm going to talk a little bit from his final chapter, which is called Faith on Earth. And I'll tell you, I have more underlining and stuff on pages 294 and 295 of his Stages book than almost any others. And it kind of talks about how the institutions we need now do several things, and you know, they take ongoing faith development of its, you know, members, you know, in the case of this, members of the church, but institutions in general, you know, their employees, their partners, or whatever. And so among the things he talks about, I won't emphasize all of them, but the first one is that we need to de-emphasize belief in terms of propositional doctrinal formulations. You know, we need to do more with, like Brad was saying, that Adam Miller was talking about, you know, faith has to be relational rather than, you know,
faithfulness rather than faith.
Yeah, yeah, loyal, you know, yeah, true relations. But then he talks about, you know, second one, emphasize faith as relational. So again, Adam Miller and Fowler right there. But then the third and fourth ones that he mentions are so important. He says, make provisions for adults to bring their struggles with faith to word. And he goes on to say, before prescriptions are offered, in other words, before we start going right to here's how I can fix you, you know, he says, before prescriptions are offered and without condemnation or accusation, give them the help of active listening in order to tell their present stories and visions of faith and hear those of others. And then finally, create a climate of developmental expectation. Strive to provide opportunities for vocational engagement. By this he means for everybody who feels their own unique call. He says we should strive for the opportunities for everybody to have that, and that calls forth the gifts and the emergent strengths of each individual, but also, he says, of each stage of faith. So Mary Beth was talking about, you know, no matter where your society or your group or your organization is centered, you've got children and adolescents and everybody growing up along the way. We need to know that all of those things are necessary, important, good, and we need to honor all of those. But, you know, to be an adult institution, we have to know that adults, you know, are we need to talk. We need to not be afraid to listen and to hold more. You know what I mean? I don't know. So that's just some stuff from.
Let me give you a wonderful little example. So at Relief Society several weeks ago, when the topic was on eternal marriage, the teacher did a stunning thing. She had different people stand up and talk about eternal marriage. She had one woman who was in a long-term good marriage. She had a woman who was a long-term widow. And she had a woman who was 47, very successful, never married, talk about her pain and her question about the church and how hard it was to even come to this lesson and even wanted to leave and not come and hear it. The whole gamut, and she had one other speaker, I'm trying to remember, of how women really respond to the discussion of eternal marriage in the church.
that was the kind of adult discussion.
Oh, fantastic.
Can I share an experience, Dan?
That's the kind of thing that we need, I think. Absolutely.
I want to share an experience, too, that just so closely relates to what you're talking about. And I should preface this by saying I'm currently working on an edited volume that I'm co-editing with Seth Payne on a more pastoral and understanding approach to apologetics, to dealing with issues of doubt. And so this is part of why I'm thinking about this subject, and also because in my dissertation research, I ended up doing quite a bit of research on sort of ex-Mormon support communities and on the role that verbal taboo in Mormonism, and in particular the violation of verbal taboo, has in actually creating community belonging in ex-Mormon communities. But that's sort of a side thing. I was just looking very closely at ex-Mormons and how ex-Mormons, people who lose their faith, sort of narrate that loss. And at the same time, we just moved back out here to Utah for me to finish writing the dissertation. We were in a ward in Sandy, and my elders' quorum president comes to me and he says, my sister's going through a faith crisis, and my dad and I are going to go talk to her. We're going to have lunch with her and talk to her this week. But I guess she found this thing called the CS letter, or letter to a CS director online that details a lot of problems, and she's kind of having a major crisis. I was wondering if I could, he knows I'm an academic, that I study Mormonism, that I have sort of a background in these things. So he just wants to get some pointers on what he can say to her, right? And he asked me, will you look at the letter? And this was the first time I'd actually read the letter, by the way. I knew it existed, but the first time I actually read it. So he comes over a couple days later, and he sits down, and he wants to know, how can I respond to these particular things? And what I told him is, if you want to have any positive effect on your sister, if you want to be in any way in a position to help her weather this crisis, and if you have any hope that that you'll somehow be able to keep her from leaving the church altogether, and you got to have your dad in on this if he's going to be there too, the advice that I'm going to give you is, don't try to solve anything.
Nice.
Don't try to address any of her concerns right now. Listen only. If you say anything, it's only to affirm that you understand what she's saying. But listening does two things. One is it signals to her that it's safe to talk to you, and that you're not going to get defensive on behalf of the church, that you're not going to treat her like suspiciously, you're not going to treat her like she's stupid, you're not going to treat her like she's unfaithful, that it's safe to talk to you, and that you understand where she's coming from. And it's not just about signaling those things to her, it's about actually understanding, because if you actually listen, you'll realize there may be 75 things in the CES letter, but really there's probably just a couple that really are difficult for her. And if you listen closely, you'll probably be able to zero in. And you'll earn the opportunity to, in a subsequent conversation with her, have her actually want to hear what you have to say substantively about one or two of these questions. But if you try to answer them immediately, you're gonna lose. It's gonna fail. It's gonna blow up in your face. It's just gonna send her the message that she can't talk to you. So you just have to actively listen.
That's great. That kind of brings up a question for me that I sort of want to throw out, and that is, we've talked a lot in the discussion so far about how we as members can be more adult in our stance toward the church, and we touched a little bit on at what developmental level we might think that the church is. But when you think about, Brad, with the example that you just shared of someone listening carefully and not getting defensive and leaving space for someone to have the questions or concerns or doubts that they have, I mean, what I'm hearing there is a very adult model of relating to another adult or another person who is in pain, or a person who is coming at at this from a different perspective. And I guess the question that keeps coming up for me as we're having this conversation is, where is the church in this? Like, it seems to me, and this is maybe just, you know, my own experience, maybe you've had different experiences, but it seems to me that church-wide, as an institution, as a body, we are not at that place yet. And so I think that makes it harder when you're an adult dealing with, like, an adolescent, you know, thinking that we as individuals are trying to be adults, but we're dealing with an entity that's more at an adolescent stage. Like, that makes it very difficult. So I'm wondering what kinds of thoughts you guys might have on that, and how we can tell where the church is, and then sort of move into a discussion of how we can actions with the church based on our understanding of where it might developmentally.
I think I'm very cautious about saying I think the church is at this developmental level, partly because of the bigger, you know, academic discussion about developmental stages and so on. But it's mostly because it's then a projection of our own relationship to the church.
Nice.
To some extent. Yeah. We have that bias. We cannot erase that. And then we're going to easily end up in a debate with somebody else who sees it quite differently. And so I sort of pull it back down to what's my relationship within my own smaller community, such as my ward or my family, my personal relationships, how much I can integrate and include across the board on all of those, not necessarily all with each other, and stay away from saying the church is this place or that place. I will say, however, that I think the more mature a church or institution is, as we've already said, the circle of compassion and understanding and the circle of allowing privileges for all members of society to gradually gain access so they get to fill their potential are really crucial pieces about saying where somebody is developmentally. But I don't at the moment want to get stuck with saying, oh, I think it's at X stage, and then, you know, that doesn't produce higher understanding in my mind.
Good. Good point.
Yep,
yeah, and I think...
Sorry, I killed your question, Katie.
No. I mean, I think you're right. At the same time, I mean, I would push back on that just a little bit and say
sure.
That while I do agree that, you know, sort of like the saying, all politics are local, all church experience is local as well. To a certain extent, I think that's really true. On the other hand, I do feel as though there is a sense... Where especially in a church like ours that is so centralized, do you know what I mean? And there is such a culture of conformity, and there is such a culture of like obedience to leadership and things like that, that I think that I can really see the point not wanting to make hard and fast rule or a diagnosis, if you will, of where the church is. But I think that kind of making everything completely local might, to a certain extent, kind of leave out this element of the centralized institution and the messages that are coming kind of from the top. Do you know what I mean?
I would. Yeah, I do agree with that. So maybe we can hold both of those in dynamic tension, right?
Well,
nice.
I want to kind of affirm both of what both of you are saying and add one dimension to it. So on the one hand, like if you go back to the example of my Elders Quorum president and my giving him very strongly worded advice on this, right? Part of the reason I was giving him that advice to affirm your concern, Katie, is that instinctively, as members of the church, conditioned by our culture, conditioned by the church as a central institution, right, our instinct in a situation where somebody expresses critical sentiment about the church in the form of that is to be defensive, is to react in a very kind of adolescent, very immature way, to react in a way that kind of blames the other person, treats that person as suspicious, you know, say, like, why are you reading stuff like this? Why are you allowing yourself to, you know, to encounter these negative materials? Can you not just be more faithful? Even if we don't say those things, like the things we say can still implicitly communicate them, our body language can, suddenly we treat another person, we sort of withdraw fellowship from that person. And it really worsens the problem. And I think that is our instinct, which is why I you know, in that particular situation, I tried so hard to get my friend to ignore his instincts in a situation like that. So that,
yeah.
I think you're absolutely right there. And I also think that that Mary Beth is right, that it's not very useful to try to sort of definitively pin down the developmental stage. And I think part of the reason why it's not is that thinking in developmental terms like this, it's not meant to be a kind of, again, like I said at the start, a kind of grand unified theory of what the church is. Rather, this is it's a heuristic, right? It's helpful to the extent that it's helpful. And if we can think in developmental terms, it can allow us to be more patient with the church as an institution, to be more patient with one another, to be more charitable. And that's exactly my third point, which is that one of the things that we can do, even if we feel like we want to approach it from a more adult perspective, and oftentimes we look at the church generally and see a less mature form, so to speak, is to be patient, is to find ways to exercise patience and charity toward the institution. In other words, to be the bigger person, for lack of a less cliched, approach to it.
So one may be a way to integrate this is to, rather than saying the church is an institution overall, is to say, if we really interested in developmental stages and the, child, adolescent, adult state would be, how do I assess conference talks? Let's parse it out. How about conference talks? What about the lesson manuals? What about the culture within my own ward? What about even different people I have to interact with who will be along many developmental stages? How do I then use it as a tool in particular situations?
Yes.
And then, for instance, I'm sitting listening to conference talks. I'm going to have different reactions to different people. I can even tag my brain, for my developmental stage three, this is there, this is there, this is there. But then it helps inform, where do I want to go next? One little device I use is that when I go to church, I take a journal so that I can not just put down notes, I think, about what people say are important, but I can give my reactions. If I'm disturbed by something a lot, I can, write it down, but what am I then going to do with it? So that's been very helpful as kind of a little workbook for me to do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the things I'm also picking up here is we need to eliminate the value judgment of where a church or an individual is, in any kind of stage, kind of a developmental model. I mean, do you blame a child for being a child? Do you blame an adolescent for, we got to get rid of that and just simply look at
sometimes.
Right. And we just need to look at it as a mirror. Here's the situation right now. Here are the tensions. Here's the dynamics at play, and to quit good, bad, right, wrong, get rid of all that kind of stuff with us. Somewhere along the line, it was a guy named Bernard Loomer is an important thinker in my life, and just, I'm sure he wasn't the first one to articulate this, but he was where I picked it up from. He really just started talking about what is a real relationship? What is a genuine relationship? And one of the key things about it is there is no preconceived end in which, in order for me to want to continue this relationship, the other person in the relationship has to, look like, end up like, etc. In other words, we have all these relationships with each other, but when we're trying to shape them into just what we think is the acceptable pattern or the acceptable way of being or seeing things exactly my way, we have not yet developed a genuine relationship. But the other part of a genuine relationship is this desire for the full flourishing of the other. That's what matters. That's all I care. And that's the way I look at what God is. God would just simply say, if I'm going to believe in a God, it's going to be like whatever this weirdness that ended up being Dan Weatherspoon at this moment in the eternal scheme of things. Whatever it is, I want this dude to be huge. I want him to flourish in every single aspect with his unique contribution to make and stuff like that. And I don't need him to be Peter Priesthood, or I don't need him to be this exact model of something like this. I want full flourishing. So if we can kind of balance that, and if our church could just simply, like James Fowler was kind of saying, let those who, each of us in our own vocation, and again, I mean by that, what is it we're called to be from God to be in this life?
Right.
Whatever it is that we sort of sense is our life's mission or something, if we would just let those things flourish, that's to me what adulthood is, the ability to form real relationships. And honestly, I think that one-on-one with any general authority, you know, not any, okay, but most general authorities, you sit across from them and you truly get to know each other, I think they would see that, that this person is exactly who they should be at this moment in time, and more power to them, and I want this church to have a place for them. The problem happens to be when, you know, they only can think in the abstract, they only can think of the institutional, they can't personalize it. And so I think our church just needs to, you know, grow in that confidence in its own self, that it's big, that it's going to survive, you know. Just like as we as adults, we have to own our whole history. I mean, that's what a midlife crisis is, right, Mary Beth? It's kind of like the road's not taken. You know, it's like
right.
making peace with this. And we don't totalize one aspect of our life and say that, you know, that is the most important thing, the way you might do it as an adolescent. You might say, yep, I've got this weakness, I've got this strength. Neither one of these fully defines me. And if our church could, you know, say it's at peace with its own history, if it could own its own vulnerability and its own weakness, then it can honor complexity. Then it can honor everyone's voice and opinion. So that's what I want to see. But also, I think it's up to us, and Mary Beth, maybe you could talk about this in parenting. When does the parent know that the child really is becoming an adult? It's when they kind of demand it. Treat
well,
me like an adult,
when they start acting like an adult. Now,
that's what I meant by not demanding it with words so much as it's like, I can't, who am I going to stop you? You're ready.
Well, that is an adult. That is an adult parent. Not all parents are adults.
No.
So
nice.
One of my little private theories is that when a child reaches or goes beyond, when a child goes beyond the level of the parent's emotional maturity, not cognitive, not physical, when the child grows beyond the parent's emotional maturity, from then on there will be irreconcilable differences, and it will be the child's responsibility to negotiate as an adult as possible relationship with that parent.
That is so important.
Which I think then is the more adult we are, we negotiate a relationship with the church or really foster other people to develop the kind of relationships we're talking about here. So, but I have one other comment, and that is, even though I agree with you, Dan, about a non-judgment and a compassionate approach, there are, in fact, abuses at times.
Yes, I was going to bring that up.
Within the ecclesiastical structure, within... You know, the statements have been made about people even in the larger culture. And so one of the naughtier or more difficult problems as an adult of God or adult of our faith or adult of whatever is, how do we approach abuse? What do we do? Do we actively intervene? Do we passively intervene? In the sense that we, you know, for instance, if I hear something that's really judgmental and fear-inducing in the gospel doctrine class, I'll raise my hand and I'll try to direct it towards something that's more compassionate. That's fairly passive and minor. But what do we do about abuse? And I don't know that it should be the biggest focal point. I don't think it should. But in fact, it's there.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think we do have to reconcile ourselves to the existence of abuse. And that happens on two levels at least. One is that we have to figure out, as individuals who see abuse and see varying kinds, varying degrees of abuse, how we're going to respond to that. You know, dealing with the question, for example, of whether you can more effectively respond or reform abusive practices as an insider, as an outsider, from a kind of passive, quiet, behind the scenes perspective or in a public way. But there's also the question of how we're going to relate to other people in the church that experience abuse or that don't experience abuse in a different way than we do. Because, as a Utah born and raised straight white male, like I just have not experienced much direct abuse at the hands of church leaders or structural abuse in general. I mean, we've all had our little moments, but my experience is going to be nothing like so many other people's. My experience as a male is not going to be the same as the experience, the wide variety of experiences that women have, abusive and non-abusive. It's not going to be the same as the different experiences that LGBT persons have. It's not going to be the same experience as a white person that people of color have. And so you know, it's just we have to have compassion for the different experiences that other people have, and that compassion has to be born of an awareness and an acknowledgement, recognition that the abuse is happening.
So I guess this is something that, like, I wrestle with, and that I even wrestle with, like, on a sort of practical level, not an intellectual level, but like, this is something that I'm wrestling with in my own relationships and in my own interaction with the church. And that is, it's really difficult because, to a certain extent, based on my own past experiences, maybe negative, quasi-abusive experiences, you know, within the church structure, I feel a sense of constant vigilance in terms of how I'm interacting with the institution. I feel like I have to be careful all around to set boundaries, and to make sure that that I'm safe and that my children are safe. And there's also a sense of a lack of total authenticity where I feel like, gosh, if they knew what I thought in my ward, if they knew that I think women should be ordained, or that, you know, that gay marriage, marriage equality should be, you know, a thing for everyone, and, you know, gays should get married in the temple, and, you know, I mean, things like this, if they knew what I believed about these things, then I feel this sense that I would be, my standing within the community would be in jeopardy, and so I hold those things back. And so I feel like it's just a really difficult, you know, balancing act and negotiation relationally, and sometimes it's just really exhausting. And I guess that's not so much a question as it is a comment, and I don't know maybe if there's feedback on that, because my guess is that I'm not the only one who feels that way and who finds him or herself in that position.
Well, I have an interesting position of being a therapist, and people show up and give me all sorts of stories of abuse, and some of them are within the church, and some are by ecclesiastical leaders, and some are by their parents, and so on. And, of course, I can do nothing directly about this. I'm only to help them do something differently. And so my focus tends to be to acknowledge and understand the listening that Brad was talking about earlier, to understand gradually until they feel really understood and validated that what they're saying makes sense, what's happened to them has a rationale, there's a way to view it, and then to help them develop more adult ways of responding, adult ways of being assertive, not just fighting or leaving or whatever, particularly in families if they can't. And I don't have an agenda, by the way, if somebody stays in the church or leaves it, that's not my job. But it's been very interesting for me to look at how I have to hold my seat and stay neutral and not have an agenda for them if I am triggered by something that I have experienced that has been difficult. But essentially, the sum of what I'm saying is to really explore what are adult responses, what are collaborative responses, what are assertion with warmth and understanding in them if you're countering another person. So that's really primarily how I work with it. Although I have worked with other things in terms of speeches and being on committees that work on different projects and so on.
Well, my approach is that is in part, and this is maybe the answer to the question of what it means to me to have an adult relationship, not just with the church, but with, you know, with other members of the church and other Mormons, maybe who aren't members of the church, is to recognize that I shouldn't expect others to be where I am or like I am. And that goes in two directions. I'm in kind of an interesting position just because on the one hand, I'm very critical of a lot of what the church does, and I don't have anything like a traditional or an orthodox approach to an approach which, by the way, I would characterize as very childlike, to sort of the church's role, the church's perfection, the church's the overall, you know, goodness coefficient of the church. You know, I'm out of the ordinary. I'm out of the mainstream when it comes to that. On the other hand, I'm largely at peace with the church, with my membership in the church. I like being a Mormon. In some ways, Mormonism means as much to me as anything in the world. and I'm deeply committed to the church, which means that I don't share certain things with my co-religionists, you know, with most Mormons who have the same level of commitment that I do to the church, but just don't think of the church in general in it all the same way. But there are also certain things that I don't share with folks that share my critical perspective toward a lot of what the church does. Just because for a lot of them, it's more difficult to have the degree of commitment that I have to it. So on the one hand, it means that I don't expect the church. In fact, frankly, I don't even know that I think that the church would be a better place if most Mormons were like me. I mean, I think the church is a healthy institution. Of course, it's got problems, and of course, there are reforms that I want to see the church adopt, and there are things that I want to see improve. But I'm fine on the margins as long as I'm allowed to be here. I'm fine if I don't represent the mainstream of the church, and I think that people with who are more conventionally Mormon, a little less like me, make the church into a strong, vibrant institution with really, you know, really strong boundaries and really a really strong sense, you know, sense of identity and you know, group identity, individual identity. So I don't expect the church to change to be like me, although obviously there are certain things that I would hope to see change. But it also means that I have to exercise patience toward people who share my degree of frustration or critical attitude towards some of what goes on in the church, but aren't able as easily as I am to maintain a close relationship with it and have compassion for people who leave because they see the same things that I do, but you know, for them the answer, the developing a healthy adult relationship with the institution is to walk away from it. And I have to find ways of acknowledging and respecting that and overcoming or suppressing what is sometimes my impulse to like roll my eyes at it, to dismiss somebody as taking the easy way out or something. Like, who am I to judge that?
Right.
Thanks, Brad. Mary Beth, I understand that you need to leave so in a few minutes here, but we want to give you a chance again to kind of share any final thoughts that you might have, respond to sort of what's taken place in this discussion, and, you know, leave us all with a bit of parting wisdom before you go.
Well, I want to say that I really support and agree with what Brad just said. I see myself as a heterodox Mormon, and I like having all the complexity and diversity of being able to move in my analogy, various rooms of my relationship to the church. Like, this is a larger house, and I have different relationships and different, you know, with people, with my ward, with my discussion with the larger church, with other people. And I've come to enjoy that complexity. One of the things in developmental stage theory is that as you move wider in your circle of compassion and consciousness of understanding, that you enjoy complexity. You enjoy paradox. You enjoy ambiguity because you enjoy that dynamic tension, or as Brad said, the optimized tension between all of these factors. And I think that's where I am. And so thank you so much for inviting me. It's been a great discussion. And again, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mary Beth.
Thanks, Mary Beth. It's been a joy having you.
Great. Talk to you soon.
Hey, let me follow up a little bit with you on you, Brad. In some ways, what I'm hearing you saying, I got two thoughts. So some ways what I'm hearing you say is, you know what? I am the adult in the room in terms of at least my understandings, you know, the understandings of the complexities and things like this. Would you go so far to say, and because sometimes I say this to myself, I don't know if I've ever said it aloud, you know, I'm the adult in this room, and boy, sometimes it sucks to be the adult. You know, Mary Beth was kind of talking about there's also the benefits of it. You know, we all long for our childhood. We all long for the simpler life and things like that. But most of us wouldn't trade, you know, all the richness that comes with adulthood stuff just for that, right? So the same thing here. We sometimes feel a little bit like, okay, I've seen things. You know, and here's where I always want to qualify. In terms of goodness, in terms of holiness, in terms of so many other areas, you know, I don't feel like the adult in the room in my hyperscorm type thing. But in terms of having examined so many things and being aware of so much historical stuff and aware things don't add up and the doctrinal development and all that stuff, I know I'm the adult in the room, and it's hard. And I choose, like you, to not always say something, to not always share that. But, you know, are you comfortable with saying it sucks to be the adult sometimes?
Well, yeah, that's part of what ends up happening is you see yourself as sort of having this more mature perspective on things, right? But then you also beat yourself up a little bit for assuming such a kind of condescending perspective, like.
And that's good that we do that.
I think that's
both
important.
See it and beat ourselves up about it. Yeah.
And I am. I do find myself sometimes really sincerely envying others. Because I remember what it was like. I remember that relationship of absolutes that I had with Mormonism during and after my mission, you know. And there's a kind of magic quality to the world that exists when you feel yourself deeply attached to something that you regard in that way. And I see it in others sometimes. I mean, I can see a kind of vibrancy and a kind of light that they have in their lives over having this very simplistic but profound, you know, deeply held conviction about and an absolute conviction about what the church is and what its destiny is and stuff. And I just sometimes I really envy it. Sometimes I really long for it. I wish it was recoverable. And I try not to just roll my eyes at myself for that, but for you know, longing for a more childlike relationship. But the other thing is that for me the strategy isn't always just to say, look, I'm just going to keep quiet. I've worked really hard in recent years, you know, let's say in the last 5 or 6 years, to develop a voice, kind of cultivate my own voice in church, like when I'm actually worshiping with others, when I'm in Sunday school, when I'm in elders' quorum, when I'm speaking in sacrament meeting, that I feel on the one hand does convey something of the maturity or the complexity or whatever that I feel uniquely, not uniquely, but close to uniquely characterizes my perspective, you know, in the room, but that resonates with more conventional Mormons, and that isn't obtrusive, that doesn't make them uncomfortable. Right. So trying to, and for me, that's been a very healthy exercise. I feel like it's been largely successful, that I am pretty good at it. It's sort of making a contribution that I feel substantively reflects my different perspective, but that doesn't just sound like a gotcha comment that doesn't rub people the wrong way. And that's been a very healthy exercise for me. It's made church a more positive experience for me.
And you had to practice it.
Oh, yeah. It took a long time.
Lots of trial and error and lots of screw-ups. And
I didn't used to be good at it. I feel like I am good at it now, and I did not used to be good at it.
Yeah, I have a failure rate about 1 in 5 now instead of 4 in 5.
Yeah.
So that kind of thing. Yep, I hear you. Oh, that was great stuff. Katie, did you want to jump in that? Because I did have one other little piece on Brad's last large comment before Mary Beth left.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
The other thing, Brad, is you kind of expressed a little bit about, you know, there's these, you know, you're fairly comfortable within the church, and yet there's these changes you want to make, you want to see made, and yet you were kind of like, you know, you're being humble, like you're supposed to be, in terms of, like, I realized that. And just one word that kept pressing, you know, coming through my mind is, you know, the word speed. It's almost like the speed of change.
Yeah.
And I just reckon that's just one of the things that has grown up within me is, you know, you always want to move, you know, you always want to persuade people. You always, you know, if you're comfortable with yourself, if you feel like you've got something that's light and better, you know, lighter and better and more enriching, you want to share that. But on the other hand, you know, just like we can't rush somebody from childhood and straight to adulthood, mm-hmm. you know, we can't rush the church through it. And, you know, and we've had all these unconscious forces of the culture, you know, and, you know, like somebody was talking earlier, and I think it might have been you, but abuse, you know, or something like that. You know, there's like, think of families that never spoke about their problems.
Yeah.
You know, and we had a church that would just trained ourselves to not speak about polygamy, you know,
any
and
of
to,
our problems.
To, yeah, and we this deep shame, but you know, yet, you know, in the 20th century, you know, towards the end of the 20th century, nobody really could name that deep cultural shame. But now we can name it. We can, you know, mm-hmm. honor it. We can see it and things like this. And so now that we're starting to move that within the church, you know. It's moving in the direction I want, so I'm going to own the fact that I wanted the church to move in this direction, but I recognize that I'm not going to get everything that I want right now, and it wouldn't be, like you said, it wouldn't be healthy for the church to be a bunch of yous.
No, it wouldn't.
Same thing, it wouldn't be healthy with a bunch of me, but yet on the other hand, I'm not going to feel ashamed of the fact that I do think the arc is moving in at least a lot of the areas that I center in, and I'm glad for that, but I'm comfortable that it can't be as speedy as my impatient self would want.
I feel the same way, and I think that there's another dimension to that too, which is something that that I've had to sort of grudgingly over time come to give the church some credit for as an institution, which is that it's not just a matter of sheer inertia that's making the change so glacial. It's that the church is actually I'm not gonna ascribe this to any sort of conscious approach or strategy that individual church leaders are taking, but I think that if you look at the way that the church changes, if you look in the, especially in the past century, there's an interesting kind of model for change, which is that the church is capable of actually instituting radical change, but it does it in a particular way, and it does it in a way that conceals the change almost in the process
yeah.
as it's happening, and then when you get to the other side of change, it doesn't feel like you've undergone a radical shift. And so it's a change that preserves the facade of continuity, but that's an important facade. So if you look at 1978, you look at the way that we remember 1978, for example, the way most... I'm not talking about the way academics talk about 1978. I'm talking about the way that most church members who are aware, and even church members who experienced 1978, they remember it as something that by the time it came was totally inevitable and was almost just a formality. Everybody was waiting for it. Everybody
right.
was expecting it.
Right.
Everybody wanted it. Everyone was praying for it. Everybody knew it was going to happen. And then it was just this kind
not
of...
Not
true. This kind of, you know, it wasn't a radical shift. When it happened, it just sort of it was a natural step forward, and that's the way that we remember it. And there's an interesting dimension to this, and I think it's a symptom of the fact that we're actually incorrectly remembering it. And to me, it's a parallel, I think, to another radical transition in the church, which is the shift from Joseph's leadership to Brigham's leadership. But there are no contemporary accounts of people seeing Joseph Smith and Brigham Young.
Right.
But a lot of people that were there later write about remembering seeing it, right?
Right.
Now, I am confident, I am 100% confident that not every single adult Mormon in the state of Utah simultaneously pulled their car over and started crying when they heard about the 78 revelation. Yet I have heard people describe doing that
yeah.
so many times. And I have to believe that they really remember doing it. Even though I don't believe for a second that they actually all did it. And Mitt Romney
yeah.
did it. I mean, he described it during the campaign, but almost anybody that you know from that who was old enough to be driving, who was an adult in 1978, will tell you they remember pulling their car over, hearing about it on the radio, shedding a quiet tear. That narrative is emblematic of how we have reprocessed and kind of re-narrated that entire transition. So the church undergoes, takes itself through a very radical change, a very radical shift in how we, not just in a policy, but in how we understand the significance of race and lineage and everything, paves the way for a really radical sort of intergenerational shift when it comes to racial prejudice and stuff. And yet we basically remember it as just kind of as a moment of continuity rather than change.
Yeah. And there's kind of a wisdom to that, right? There's a payoff that we shouldn't be overly critical about.
This is what I'm saying, and so it's helpful. I mean, I think it's really funny, for example, if you look at the present culture, you see two things happening at once. You see very, very obvious, inescapable evidence that the church is in fact changing in the process right now of shifting on the question of homosexuality. And at the same time, a conviction on the part of most church members, a sincere, absolute conviction that this is the one thing that absolutely cannot change. And those two things are happening simultaneously. Our conviction that something can't change and will not change and is fundamentally unchangeable exists alongside actual change on that thing.
Yeah. Nice.
And that's an impressive thing for an institution to pull off.
Like you say, whether they're doing it on purpose or it's happening. Yeah. No, I agree with that. That's a good reminder.
Wow. Thank you. Yeah, that was a great insight. You guys, this has been a wonderful conversation. I've learned a whole lot, mm-hmm. and I really appreciate. Yeah, really appreciate the chance to be a part of it and to kind of listen in on this discussion. I want to remind our wonderful listeners of Mormon Matters that this is something that Dan does as a labor of love, but it is very, very helpful, I know, to Dan, and certainly shows a level of support from everyone. If you enjoy Mormon Matters, if it helps you, if it's something that lifts you up and makes you think and is of value to you in your life, to be sure to donate to Mormon Matters. You can do that at mormonmatters.org. And also,
Thank you for bringing that up.
Of course. And also, I know that there will certainly be a robust discussion on the website, too. So go to mormonmatters.org, and I'm sure Dan will link to the past podcasts that we sort of have mentioned throughout the course of this episode. And my bet is that Brad and or Mary Beth and Dan will be around to engage in further conversation as we go. So thank you guys so much. It's been super awesome.
Thanks a lot.
Cue the music.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive, or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.
All is well.